This podcast of The Exchange is sponsored by Dartmouth Hitchcock, creating a new model for healthcare where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us. A sustainable system improving the health of our communities for years to come. Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And the Dagoba Group, a global diversity and inclusion consulting practice with specialties in unconscious bias, leadership dynamics, and client engagement. Authors of the book, The Inclusion Dividend. More at thedagobagroup.com.
And Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org. Federally insured by NCUA, Equal Housing Opportunity.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Almost half a decade has passed since the Affordable Care Act was signed in early 2010, but the law's two key components, expanded Medicaid and the health insurance exchanges, continue to face challenges, both political and financial. Here in New Hampshire, widening the pool of low-income people eligible for Medicaid has meant 40,000 more Granite Staters covered and a noticeable drop in uncompensated care for hospitals. But in a few years, the state will have to kick in a lot more money to keep this benefit going, and some lawmakers are concerned we can't afford it. Meanwhile, the health insurance exchanges have come under sharp scrutiny. Some insurers are dropping out of the program, saying they aren't able to make money, and those companies who remain operating on the exchanges have raised costs for the individual consumer, sometimes by more than 20%. Still, even with all these questions, the law's supporters say there's one number that weighs strongly in the ACA's favor: a significant drop in the number of Americans without health insurance. Today in The Exchange, a checkup on the Affordable Care Act. We'll start out by looking at New Hampshire and then see what's happening nationally. And let's hear from you, too. Your questions and comments are welcome at 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. We have three guests in studio. Ray White is here, health insurance broker and former Republican state senator from Bedford. And Ray White, good to see you. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me, Laura.
Also with us, Marianne White, no relation, policy analyst at New Hampshire Voices for Health and former healthcare navigator. And Marianne, nice to meet you. Thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me on.
And also with us is Bob Sanders, longtime reporter for the New Hampshire Business Review. He's been covering how the Affordable Care Act has been affecting businesses here in the Granite State. And Bob, welcome. Good to see you.
Great to be here.
Well, and Bob, I want to start with you because you've been writing a lot about the ACA's impact on New Hampshire companies, both small and large. But you also said recently, Bob, let's pull back and take a look at the big picture. What is that big picture about the Affordable Care Act here in New Hampshire, Bob?
Well, I mean, the truth is, and I think everybody recognizes this, that it has cut the number of uninsured pretty much to half in terms of percentage-wise. So it was about 14. I think we're getting close to 8. So unemployed, uninsured. It has driven down the cost of health care. There was a study by the Hospital Association on emergency use. It's gone down tremendously. The study was to show that the Medicaid expansion works, but it doesn't really say how much is Medicaid expansion, how much is people going on the exchange in the Affordable Care Act.
Yeah, so we'll be talking about both components of the ACA this hour. So hospitals, Bob, especially have liked this thing because it means more people coming through their doors have coverage.
Yes, and especially when we're talking emergency room, it's very expensive. So if they can get to people before with more preventative care, which is the whole idea behind ACA, that would cut the general cost. And in a sense, it depends on where you go on this, because nobody knows what would have happened without the ACA. But the premiums have slowed, at least under the both in terms of group insurance. In other words, they're still going up, but they're not going up as much as they were, or as much as they were expected. And part of that is because a lot of that cost is taken out of it.
Well, and I'll turn to our other guests too, Bob, but one more question for you. I have read that premiums are not, you know, skyrocketing like they used to. That's the monthly amount that you pay, right, for your health coverage. But yet people are paying a lot more out of pocket, you know, deductibles, oh, that's not quite covered, or for medicines and so forth. So what are you seeing there, Bob?
Well, since everything is price driven, it's kind of like the airlines. You know, they get you. They say your fare's lowest, but then they start charging you for your bags and this
right.
and that, and so people really. And then it becomes more complicated to shop because you got to figure out. Well, so the same thing with healthcare. They don't cover. They get the premiums down to get those people in the door. They get you. They catch you with deductibles. They catch you with copays. So you got to compare all that. It's complicated. There's a number of people doing things to try to take that complication away. But yes, the deductibles are going up, and they continue to go up. The good thing, I suppose, is that it might give people pause to get the most expensive test. And so forth to save money that way. But it also might be doing exactly what the Affordable Care Act wanted to prevent, which is it might have people put off going to the doctor.
Because of the deductibles.
And then they come up, they go into the emergency room, and then that costs more. So.
Yeah, so as a consumer, you look at the prices and you go, oh, this one is, you know, $200 a month. That sounds great. But then it turns out your benefits don't really kick in until you spend, you know, $5,000. And there's a lot of sticker shock out there for folks. I want to turn to you too, Ray White and Marianne White, and just ask you very broadly, Ray White, first. It's called the Affordable Care Act. Has it been affordable? What do you think?
Well, I think we're focusing on just the insurance side when we look at the Affordable Care Act. But the quick answer to your question, Laura, is no, I don't think things are affordable. But I don't think it's all about Obamacare. I don't think it's about insurance. It's about the cost of care. Pharmaceuticals in particular are just totally out of control from a price standpoint, doctors and so forth. When an insurance company sets rates, they have to set their rates for 2016, you know, many months ago, and then they can't change them. But doctors can raise their rates, hospitals can raise their rates, pharmaceutical companies can raise their rates. Personally, I fill a prescription every month, and no joke, every month I go, I see it go up $10-15 every month.
Wow.
And every time I fill it, I'm just amazed that even though my copay is the same, I see the retail cost on the ticket, and I say, boy, what are they just building a monthly trend to this thing? And so until the cost of care is addressed, which really not we're not really discussing now, health insurance is going to go up because it's a reflection of the underlying cost.
So the Affordable Care Act focused more on insurance, Ray, and not so much on the cost of care, and that's the problem?
Well, I think it focused on covering people, and it, as Bob mentioned, it focused on preventative care. All the plans for sale in New Hampshire have 100% benefit for preventative care, so there's no copay, no deductible, no anything on preventative care. But there's still a lot of cost drivers in the system that are not just about coverage and preventative care. And those really haven't been addressed. They're hard to address because every one of them comes with a well-organized lobby that's very powerful. There's a lot of powerful interest in healthcare, and so it's very hard to corral the whole system.
Well, give us an example of the powerful lobbying forces and how you see those driving up the costs, Ray.
Well, I'll focus on pharmaceuticals again. The pharmaceutical companies with the Part D, which, again, we're not discussing today, but Part D of Medicare, got a bill passed that basically said the government would not knuckle them on costs. They made some agreements to soften the donut hole, the famous donut hole Part D, and part of those agreements were that they would have some pricing structure that I don't think is fair. And certainly in the presidential race, many people, I think most notably Senator Clinton, has got commercials running saying that, you know, she's going to address this. Everybody's aware that pharmaceuticals are a problem right now.
Well, and I want to let everybody know that as we check up on the Affordable Care Act, we'll be talking about the two big components, the exchanges and the Medicaid expansion. That's especially a big deal here in New Hampshire. But while we're talking about the exchanges, I'll turn to you, Marianne White. And there is some concern that the Affordable Care Act has been more affordable for some than others. I wonder what you think.
Yeah, I mean, for some aspects, I do definitely agree with you, Ray, on that. But, you know, from anecdotal evidence that we've seen, you know, within New Hampshire Voices and other organizations and, you know, that provide on-the-ground assistance, whether it's navigators or in-person assisters, that, you know, it has become affordable for a lot of people in New Hampshire, whether it's people that were previously uninsured because of, you know, advanced premium tax credits that have become available. You know, there's a lot of really great anecdotal evidence of, you know, stories of people in New Hampshire who are now covered and are seeing their physician and doctors who are not previously, you know, getting care and have had access to care that they needed.
A navigator, again, is what you used to do, Marianne.
Yes.
Tell us what that is.
Yes, correct. So navigators had to go through extensive training through the marketplace, know the intricacies, know the ins and outs of the system, enrolling people, know the plans like the back of your hand. You cannot, you know, tell people what plans to pick, but you can, you know, go through all the plans, explain to them the, you know, the different educational components around it, you know, what's coinsurance, copays, deductibles, and really help them, you know, navigate them to make the best decision regarding their healthcare needs.
And we hear, you know, nationally anyway, we hear a lot of headlines about people kind of having sticker shock with the exchanges. And even though maybe the premiums, as Bob Sanders explained, don't seem to be going up that much, there's all these other costs that seem to be more and more embedded and people are getting some unpleasant surprises. Is part of the problem, Marianne, that people aren't navigating it correctly, or what's going on there?
Yeah, I mean, looking from open enrollment 1 to open enrollment 3, which we're currently in right now, we went from having around, you know, 12 plans to now 48 plans. And, you know, that creates a lot of confusion amongst people that don't necessarily know how to navigate the, you know, what exactly is a deductible and what does that mean from a, you know, $1,000 deductible, but, you know, to a $5,000 deductible. And, you know,
$5,000 deductible, that's a lot.
Yeah. I mean, you know, looking at moving forward, how can we lower those deductibles and how we can, you know, help lower some of those, some issues that we have seen regarding the marketplace. And, you know, it will take some more education and, you know, we should look at quality versus quantity when moving forward. So,
Bob, go ahead. And then I want to go to our listeners.
Just the big thing this year is that you think people will be getting used to this, even though it's getting more complicated. But this year, we're having a new population going to try to navigate this. And this is the people who are on a Medicaid expansion, people who are too poor to be on the exchange last time and too wealthy, I can, that's a bad word, but had enough income so that they didn't qualify for Medicaid. They are now in, they were being covered by Medicaid, but now they're being shifted. That's 40,000 people, that's twice, almost the same amount that's on the exchange now, are going to have to navigate this system. And these are people who are pretty much less sophisticated with dealing with all these plans.
Well, and it's very confusing for anybody to go through this. So this is the link, and we're going to talk about this, I promise. This is the interesting link, right, Bob, in New Hampshire, where, you know, you've got the exchanges, which is sort of the private market with subsidies for some folks, and you have Medicaid expansion. In New Hampshire, those two are tied together starting next year. The
right.
Folks who are under Medicaid expansion are going to have to start getting their Medicaid coverage through these private exchanges. So that's an incentive, Ray, to figure this out for the exchanges. What do you think?
Well, I think the original concept behind what New Hampshire is doing, and remember we had to get a waiver to do so, was we didn't want to stratify the market more. We felt if there were already private companies participating on one level, then they could absorb that population. But I think Bob is correct that this is not a population that's used to picking their plan, and it does make things difficult. And the role of navigators and consumer assisters becomes important in reaching those people because it is a hard-to-reach population. I, as a broker, don't really deal with or reach that population.
What do you think of the idea of this sort of New Hampshire approach toward Medicaid, Ray, and having linking, again, these two somewhat separate components of the ACA?
Well, again, if we think back of what happened, President Obama envisioned that Medicaid would be expanded in all 50 states. That was the part that the Supreme Court struck down and said, no, you can't force that on the states. And so only about half did so. And then as it became necessary to coax states in, the federal government said, well, maybe certain states can do some things differently. And there were several that tried to do some things differently, some with more success than others. We'll have to see how things play out in New Hampshire. But I think everybody's trying to get creative in terms of being fair to the insurers, being fair to the insured population, being getting everybody covered. A lot of, again, competing interests in trying to satisfy everybody with a legislative solution, I can assure you, is no picnic.
Speaking as a former state senator and further complicating this influx of new folks into the exchanges here in New Hampshire, one company is pulling out of New Hampshire's exchanges. We'll talk about that in a minute. But let's go to our listeners, all of you. The exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. Join us with your questions and comments on the Affordable Care Act. We're checking up on it today, almost 5 years in, and some changes, as we're hearing, to the act as it's rolling out in the Granite State. You can join us with your questions, comments, personal experiences, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Dave's joining us from Bedford. Hi, Dave. Thanks for calling in.
Hey, guys. Well, I had a question for you. Is it Senator White?
Former Senator White, yes.
Okay. I got the impression earlier on that you're at least somewhat in favor of this. You're somewhat in favor of the ACA.
Is that correct?
Well, right? When I was a senator, I absolutely was not in favor of it and tried to create a legislative solution in New Hampshire to soften it as much as possible. But the fact of the matter is it is the law of the land. I know a lot of Republicans running around saying that they're going to repeal Obamacare. I don't believe that is possible at this point. I think we're too far down the road. And so I'm a pragmatist, and I want to make things work as good as I can under the system, whether I agree with it or not, and that's my position.
Okay, well, that's fair enough. And if you did try to make it easier on everyone, then I do appreciate that. But the medical costs, though, are high because of the authorities' intervention over the years. I mean, is there anything you've done other than that to get the authorities out of the way of the doctors?
Again, there's a lot of competing interest, and that's a difficult thing to do. Doctors aren't monolithic in their approach to things either. There's people who are in favor of the act. There's people who are not. I'm talking about the medical profession. It's just hard to corral all these people. When I was a senator, I spoke to all concerned parties and thought there would be two opinions and found sometimes there were 20 opinions. And it's just very difficult to get everybody on the same page.
Not 24 opinions, given how many
state
senators there are. Thank you very much for the call, Dave. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. And Bob Sanders, I know you have to leave us in a couple minutes, so I did want to ask you about some of the specific coverage you've done in terms of costs for businesses. What's coming up for New Hampshire businesses under the Affordable Care Act next year? Because you wrote recently, you know, look out, lots of changes.
Well, one thing is that the long put off segment of the business community, 50 to 100 employees, now have to provide coverage or pay a penalty.
So
per
they
worker.
Were exempt up until
right.
now. Under 50, you're still. You can do whatever you want.
Under 50, you can do what you want. Even some that are very small can still get a subsidy. But the ones from 50 to 100 have to provide coverage. Now, some of these are already doing so, so it won't make much of a difference. The type of coverage they have to provide, which was going to change, the feds pulled back on that. Congress pulled back on that. So there are some changes. Another thing that all the businesses have to do is they're going to have to make these forms, these basically W-2 forms for health insurance that they have to give their employees, and they have to keep track of it. And it has to have a monthly breakdown. And it's
lots
very
of paperwork.
It's very complicated. You probably have to hire someone like Ray White's firm to do it for you or a tax accountant. So that's probably even more than the coverage is going to bother a lot of people.
Well, Bob, I'll cut you off there. Thank you so much. I think we'll need to catch up with you on this again. Thanks for being here. Bob Sanders with New Hampshire Business Review. More in a moment. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're checking up on the Affordable Care Act, and we want to hear from you, your questions or comments about this law that's almost 5 years old. We're finding out how it's been playing out in the Granite State and some of the concerns about rising costs. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Ray White, Marianne White, let's go back to our listeners. And Cindy joins us from Concord. Hi, Cindy. Go ahead. You're in the air.
Hi. Well, I'm a nurse navigator. I work for a local hospital system, and my job is to help patients and families with complex health care issues not be readmitted to the hospital by developing care plans so they can manage their own illnesses. So I deal with this every day, and two of the things that I'm seeing, I spend a lot of time on trying to help patients and families access health care because of financial barriers. And what the hospitals are actually seeing is a lot of times because of the deductibles and the gaps in the programs that you're talking about, the hospitals have financial aid programs, and they end up picking up the cost indirectly anyway if the patients can't afford to pay. So when the programs that you're talking about are inadequate because they pass on the cost to the patient, ultimately the hospitals end up paying anyway.
That's the uncompensated care that's long been a concern. Yeah. Go ahead, Cindy.
So, I mean, that's one problem. The other issue is that federally funded programs, like, for example, the BCCP, Breast and Cervical Cancer Prevention Program, when you talk about having adequate prevention, those programs are seeing dives in their numbers, and so the state is actually, and federal is threatening to cut them completely, and those programs provide free prevention for women, for example. And I have women who fall in that middle range where they can't afford the $600 to pay a premium for the exchange, which they're required to do under the ACA, but they also won't have those programs to fall back on.
Cindy, can I ask you a quick question? And sorry to jump in there. You said that hospitals are still absorbing, it sounds like you're saying, a fair bit of uncompensated care, but the Affordable Care Act was supposed to help a lot with that. So you're not seeing that, or not enough?
Well, I think that there's a lot of different factors that pass on costs to hospitals.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, hospitals have to, they don't have to, but I mean, I work for a hospital that's a nonprofit. We have a financial aid program so that if you can't afford your health care, even if you have insurance and you can't afford the deductible, if your income qualifies you for financial aid, then the hospital is going to, you know, help pick up that cost. So whether they're, you know, paying that cost like they are now, or they were eating the cost when you didn't have insurance and you weren't paying your bill.
I mean,
it doesn't matter how you do it, but you're still paying for health care for people who can't afford it if you're creating programs that have deductibles that people can't afford.
Okay. So, Cindy, thank you for calling. Yeah. And Marianne, what do you think? Boy, so we've heard a lot of concerns about uncompensated care that hospitals and other providers take on. One of the supposed benefits of the Affordable Care Act was that it would help reduce this, if not get rid of it. But Cindy's saying, well, one way or the other, they're still paying.
Yeah, and Cindy, thank you for calling in, because, I mean, you do raise a lot of really good points. And, you know, these are the voices that we need to be, you know, listening to and hearing when moving forward and thinking about how we can create, you know, programs and make these, you know, programs more efficient. You know, when looking at the uncompensated care costs, as the, you know, New Hampshire Hospital Association just came out, and as Bob Sanders pointed out earlier, looking at, you know, the decrease in uncompensated care costs, and, you know, whether that's associated with you know, New Hampshire Health Protection Program and Medicaid expansion, or the linkage with the exchange. So there are, hospitals have seen a decrease in uncompensated care costs,
but not an elimination,
right? Exactly. And, you know, looking at some of those other programs that you mentioned, you know, the cervical care program. I think that's something that, you know, we need to evaluate moving forward and how we can incorporate new programs and look at existing programs and create efficiencies there.
Well, Cindy, thank you for the call. Again, good to hear from a nurse who's right in this. Again, the number for you to join us, 1-800-892-6477. We're taking your questions, comments, observations, personal experiences with the Affordable Care Act today in the Exchange, 1-800-892-6477. Joining us now on the line is someone who's been looking at this for a long time nationally. Noam Levy is with us. He's the LA Times national healthcare reporter. He's based in the DC Bureau. And Noam, thank you so much for giving us your time. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Good to be with you.
Well, we started out the hour, Noam, asking our New Hampshire guests, is the Affordable Care Act turning out to be affordable? And I'd love to hear from you on that.
Well, as I'm sure your earlier guests discussed, I mean, the answer is not simple.
Right.
the first question, of course, is who is it affordable for? Is it affordable for consumers who are getting health insurance? Is it affordable for the federal government and taxpayers who are footing the bill for this? I think there are a number of ways to answer that question. In the big picture, if you believe, as many did, that the goal of the Affordable Care Act was to make health care more accessible to people who couldn't afford it at all before, I think it has made health care more affordable. There are millions of people now who have health insurance in New Hampshire and other states around the country who couldn't get it for one reason or another before the law was enacted, either because they couldn't afford it or because there were rules on the books that allowed health insurers to simply deny coverage to people who had pre-existing medical conditions. On the taxpayer front, this law was expensive. It's expensive to expand coverage, billions and billions of dollars. That being said, it has turned out actually to cost somewhat less than some of the independent experts expected when the law was enacted. There are a number of reasons for that, among which are the fact that some states have not fully expanded. I think probably most relevant for individual consumers and patients, though, I think for many patients, the promise that the Affordable Care Act would somehow lower the cost of their medical care is still unfulfilled. I think there's some signs of progress in the way that the healthcare system is changing that could make medical care more affordable. But there are also some other forces at work, some of which actually don't have to do with the Affordable Care Act, that are putting a bigger burden on patients. And the nurse who just called in alluded, I think, to one of the biggest challenges that remains all around the country, and that is that health plans increasingly and employers that provide health insurance to their employees are dealing with the rising price of medical care by passing along more of those costs to patients in the form of either higher deductibles or bigger copays, more cost sharing, so that when you or I go to the doctor or go fill a prescription, you know, maybe we're paying $40 or $30 instead of what we used to pay $20 for. And even more consequently, if we go to the hospital and we have a big procedure done to us or we go to the emergency room, we have to pay the first $2,500 or $5,000 of that, where before maybe our deductible was only $1,000.
Yeah, no, so it's very frustrating. Yeah, and sticker shock for folks and very unpleasant. So this could probably take us 3 hours to answer, but why is that, Noam? You said that, you know, the promise of lower prices has not yet been fulfilled for a lot of folks. We'll talk about Medicaid in a moment, but for regular people who are buying their insurance on the exchange, for example, why are those unpleasant surprises happening at the doctor's office or at the drugstore?
So there's, as you can imagine, a lot of people much smarter than I have been debating why is it that American healthcare costs so much. It turns out that we pay way more than any other industrialized country for our healthcare. And one of the often discussed culprits that we use too much healthcare, we go to the doctor too much. It turns out that's probably less the case than the fact that the price that we pay for drugs, for a trip to the doctor's office, for an x-ray, for a heart transplant, the price of medical care on a sort of individual basis is much higher in the United States than it is anywhere else in the world. And there are higher administrative costs in the United States which contribute to that. The salaries of executives and physicians, frankly, are higher in the United States than they are in Western Europe, for example, or Japan. Japanese patients go to the doctor way more than Americans do.
Really?
It turns out. But the price of going to the doctor is less. It's sort of like imagine if our televisions cost four or five times as much as they did in Germany or Holland. That's sort of the equivalent problem we have here. And Americans are reluctant to talk about regulating price, especially something as big as healthcare. We sort of have a belief in this country that if we have a market, that will help make things like televisions and computers and video games and cars more affordable. That hasn't so far worked in healthcare, and there are a number of reasons for that, which, again, we could go into further. But price is really the issue in the United States, and that sort of ripples through everything down to kind of what people's monthly insurance premiums are.
Sure, and we've been talking about those cost drivers, bending the cost curve, Noam, for a long time. But right now, you know, in the last couple years, under the Affordable Care Act, again, it's been the law of the land for almost half a decade. People go to the doctor and they pay that huge deductible, or they go to the drugstore, like Ray White said, and pay, you know, $15 more every single month. I think that's the frustration for folks, is they were hoping that the ACA would at least have a lid on this, and instead it seems to be going up even more. So I just wonder, you know, why now?
Well, it's not actually now that much. If you look at sort of what's been happening with deductibles, they've been increasing pretty steadily over the last 10, 15 years.
It's a continuation of the
long-term
trend.
We may have sort of hit a tipping point, if you will, where people are just so frustrated now and seeing it to a degree where, okay, maybe I could absorb an extra $2 or $3, but now I'm paying twice as much when I go to the drugstore. So I think we have hit a little bit of a tipping point with the price issue that sort of brought this issue to the fore. In some ways, just coincidental with the implementation of the Affordable Care Act.
Well, and Ray White, for you on the insurance end, but I want to hear from Noam and Marianne too. One of the issues that I've read about that might be contributing to recent cost increases is that insurers participating on the exchanges say they can't afford it, they can't make money on it. The people who are joining these are older and sicker than everybody expected, so you don't have that subsidization by younger, healthier people. And so they thought they weren't going to have to raise prices, they being the insurance companies. But lo and behold, they do have to, because they're not getting that mix of populations that they expected. I wonder what you're hearing about that, Ray.
Well, that's not a new problem. I've been in the insurance business for 30 years, and I always say the hardest person for me to attract and insure is the young, healthy male. He basically doesn't see any need for paying any premium at all, doesn't see any health care in his future at all. So since I've been in the business, that's always been the hardest person to insure. But nonetheless, I think that to the cost of care, which is what you're driving at, Laura, whenever you hide the cost of care, and insurance has an effect of hiding the true cost of care, when a person pays a copay for a prescription or a deductible for a procedure, they don't see the entire cost of it. And I think cost transparency would go a long way. You know, why can't you walk into a hospital and see a menu board in the emergency room and says, for this procedure, it costs this much, like you do at McDonald's? I think that and this is a problem that really began in the 60s when insurance and Medicare was created in the 60s. It began to hide the true cost of health care. And so I think people a little bit have an unrealistic expectation of what costs are and what they should be. On the other hand, there's no question that hiding of costs has been exploited by, again, the hospitals, the doctors, the pharmaceutical companies, because they feel like, well, hey, if we get most of the cost paid for by insurance. We can give people a break on the front end or something like that, but we'll just charge whatever we want on the back end. And again, that's why the whole cost of care thing has entered the political discourse, because now it's getting to the point where people, like even myself, who's a right-wing capitalist, says maybe there's some price gouging going on here. This really isn't fair. Maybe we need to treat healthcare providers and pharmaceutical companies like utilities. They provide something that's absolutely necessary, and if they're going to act in an unreasonable fashion in terms of their pricing, then maybe that needs to be looked at.
Mary Ann, I'd like to hear from you too on this. Some insurers have said we have to raise deductibles and other out-of-pocket costs. Sorry, folks, but we have to, because we're not getting the right mix of people participating in these exchanges.
Yeah, and I think that goes back to a lot of the education component surrounding the exchange. And, like I've been saying this since the beginning, this is a marathon, not a sprint. And we're going to be feeling these growing pains, over the next, enrollment periods and over the next couple of years, most likely. And, how can we bring the young invincibles into the exchanges and really looking at preventative care and how, moving forward, we can, convince them that this is something that is necessary, in ensuring that we're covering these populations and hopefully lowering costs that way.
So do young invincibles start to pay a premium, more of a premium or more of a fee, so to speak, Mary Ann, for not signing up for insurance?
Yeah. So, as of right now, it's, you will see that the fee, if you don't have insurance for three consecutive months. And going back to the education component, having insurance is better than not having insurance. You never know the unintended consequences of not having insurance, and gosh forbid something happened to you. There's a story from one of our application counselors in Nashua. They had worked with someone in their 20s who was adamantly convinced that he did not need insurance. He'd never been sick, never been hurt before, but they had convinced him to sign up for a catastrophic plan. And lo and behold, a couple weeks later, he ended up breaking a bone. And, what kind of cost would he have incurred if he had not had insurance and been able to turn towards that?
Let's take a call. And again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Sheila's joining us from Concord. Hi, Sheila. You're on the exchange. Go ahead.
Hi. I'm just responding to what Ray White just said about transparency in healthcare and in facilities. He was in the legislature. Why doesn't the legislature pass a bill that says that all healthcare facilities have to post their charges so that when somebody is going into the emergency room, they see what the costs are? When somebody is getting an x-ray, they see what those costs are, or an MRI, so that we really know what these charges are going to be.
Sheila, thank you for the question. And Ray, correct me if I'm wrong, New Hampshire sort of has something like that, right? The insurance department tried to do something online to reveal those costs.
Yeah, the insurance company, I'll give out a shout out to Tyler Brennan over there at New Hampshire Insurance Department, has a transparency tool, and it works as good as can be. But it's not up to just the insurance department. The providers have to be willing to play ball. And candidly, the providers think it's a competitive advantage not to share their underlying cost as hospitals compete with each other for certain procedures and so forth. Little war story personally, when my son Justin was born, I had the type of insurance back then that didn't have maternity coverage. Both me and my wife were in our 40s, so we took the risk. And so I went to the hospital and said, hey, we got a uninsured pregnancy. How much? And they said, we don't know. I said, what do you mean you don't know? And they said, well, it depends on this, depends on that. And I could not get a cost out of the hospital up front. It wasn't until I got the bill that they told me the cost. And that's the way it works.
Yeah, not the time when you want to find out. But yeah, it is tricky. Thank you so much for the question, Sheila. We'll take a lot more of your questions after a short break. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're checking up on the Affordable Care Act and whether it's living up to the many promises made. Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Again, 1-800-892-6477. Our guests in studio are Ray White, health insurance broker and former Republican state senator from Bedford, along with Marianne White, policy analyst at New Hampshire Voices for Health and a former healthcare navigator. Joining us from D.C. is Noam Levy. He's the L.A. Times national healthcare reporter. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Here's an email that came in from Paul, who says, please point out that even though you have a high deductible, at least you pay a rate that is negotiated if you have insurance versus even higher prices if you had no insurance. Noam, I want to throw that to you, but frame the question a little bit differently than Paul. In Massachusetts, which is often called the precursor to the Affordable Care Act, they got the access thing down pretty quickly and pretty well, but the cost thing continues to be a struggle. Is that what we're seeing now with the Affordable Care Act?
A little bit. I mean, Massachusetts struggles with the price issue that I discussed earlier probably more than almost any state in the country. As you know, Massachusetts is home to Partners Healthcare, the MGH, Children's Hospital, the Brigham. These are world-class hospitals that historically have, you know, earned tremendous reputations for their medical care. They're also extremely pricey. And a lot of the medical care that's provided around Massachusetts is very expensive. Massachusetts, though, is interesting because they have turned in a very comprehensive way to addressing some of the cost issues, and in this sense, I think are sort of ahead of the rest of the country in this way as well. And one of the things that they're looking at, they certainly haven't solved the problem, I should say, but one of the things that they're looking at is, are there different ways to structure the way that insurers pay for medical care to incentivize lower cost, the use of lower cost providers, and encouraging patients in turn to make better choices that will make them, A, healthier, and make them use healthcare more more rationally. So I think that may be one strategy that we see play out around the country. Some of those tools are embedded in the Affordable Care Act and are being rolled out a little bit in time. But you know, to Marianne's point about this being a marathon, not a sprint, it's going to be a while, I think, before we sort of see the extent to which those strategies can be successful.
And Miriam, what do you think about Paul's point? And thank you again, Paul, that, okay, yes, it's unpleasant to go to the doctor and you see this high deductible and, you know, high copay and so forth. He says, at least you have insurance, you would pay even more. Is that true?
Yeah. So, you know, I think going back to the unintended consequences of not having insurance and looking at, you know, the cost benefit of you know, upfront costs of the premiums and, you know, creating a healthier workforce through having that insurance available to you if need be.
Let's take another call. Thank you for the email, Paul. And Rob is in Nashua. Hi, Rob. Go ahead. You're in the air.
Hi, Laura. My comment is, there's a lot of discourse going on in politics all over the place about the national debt and the debt we're passing on to our children in the future because of tax decisions we're making now, and about subsidizing the elderly's health care with the young invincibles paying in things that on average they don't need, but we need that to subsidize the elderly, and we need to subsidize the elderly's retirement plans and things like that. Why is there no talk about creating a market condition where the elderly can pay for themselves? We're in a time when millennials are, you know, studies show that millennials are looking at having to switch careers 10 times over the course of their working lifetime, and they're fighting harder than most working generations had to find jobs. And how can they possibly save to be self-sufficient for themselves, let alone themselves when they get elderly? Why are we constantly handing things down to the younger generation to subsidize the elderly who never saved enough for themselves, while the older people are making exponentially more than young people?
Well, Rob, thank you for calling in. And this is sort of a huge philosophical question. And I'll throw it to you, Noam. You know, the idea that, boy, young people these days have a lot of struggles, college debt, you know, a tough job market. and so forth. And he's saying, you know, we've been talking about getting younger people into these health insurance pools so they can, quote unquote, subsidize older, sicker folks. And he's saying, hey, we've got our own problems. This is a little outside of our conversation today, but it does tie in. I wonder what you think, Noam.
Well, you know, the caller raises obviously a really large point, some of which relates to the Affordable Care Act specifically and some of which sort of relates more broadly to kind of what kind of country we are and what kind of safety net the country provides. The Medicare and Social Security programs essentially are transfer programs from younger people to older people, and that was sort of embedded in the principle that drove their creation in the 30s for Social Security and in the 60s for Medicare. Although it is true now that people are not paying in as much when they work as they take out once they actually retire, particularly for Medicare, because healthcare is so expensive. It's difficult to envision, I think, and this is one of the challenges for policymakers in Washington, how much more burden the elderly can assume. Many are of modest means themselves, and there are increasing amount of data that shows that that many elderly people are struggling with the burdens of affording their health care, even with the safety net that exists. So there isn't an easy answer to it. I'll say one thing really quickly about the Affordable Care Act, which does distinguish it from some of the other issues that relate to debt. The Affordable Care Act was that unusual piece of legislation which actually paid for itself. It contained a series of measures designed to raise revenues to offset the cost of expanding health insurance for young people and working-age people as well. And in that sense, also, it's somewhat unique because it is a safety net program for working-age Americans. But that actually is I think, one of the virtues, actually, of the law in the sense that it doesn't add to the debt in the way that many of the other things that the federal government does.
Well, and thank you for the call, Rob. And related to insurance, Ray White, in our conversation earlier about, you know, you said one of the toughest people to get to buy insurance is a young male, even though you need those folks in an insurance pool to, quote unquote, I hate to use the word subsidize, but subsidize older, sicker workers. That's how insurance has always worked, correct? It's a pooling of risks. And the hope is that at some point in their lives, now or 20 years from now, you'll be able to pull out of that pool.
Insurance is all about the law of large numbers, that some people are going to use care, some people are not going to use care. And the people that use care are going to use more care than they paid for, and the people that aren't going to use care are going to have to make up that difference. That's a bedrock principle of health insurance. I think what Noam was talking about is we're having a debate in this country now really about collectivism versus individualism. Who's responsible? And as he mentioned, you know, what kind of a society or country we're going to be in. Just like there's the culture wars that gets a lot of press, there is the generational wars that are kind of taking place as people live longer and older people do statistically. I'm not voicing an opinion. This is statistically provable. Older people cost more than younger people from a healthcare standpoint.
Sure. The body just starts to
break down
a little bit.
And you're going to spend roughly two-thirds of your healthcare dollars in the last couple of years of your life, unfortunately. So these are big problems, and this is why these things are hard to get your arms around. There's a lot of competing interests, a lot of competing opinions, and difficult choices sometimes have to be made, and they're going to be unpleasant to some segment of the population.
Well, glad you called, Rob. Thank you for raising that point. And Dwight is with us from Concord. Hi, Dwight. Go ahead. You're on the Exchange. Welcome.
Another good program, Laura.
Thank you.
Some years ago, I heard a healthcare executive in Pennsylvania say the following: in our current U.S. healthcare system, billions of dollars are spent by insurance companies, doctors, and hospitals to administer all the different plans. If we went to a single-payer system, one entity responsible for the administrative healthcare, the money saved in administrative costs would more than cover all the uninsured and underinsured people. Now, let me also say, I don't have exact figures, but I'm guessing the administrative cost to administer Social Security, probably 3 to 5%. Medicare more, probably 6 to 8%. My understanding is insurance companies, until the Affordable Care Act came into being, were spending 20, 25, sometimes 30% for administrative costs. And I think under ACA, they're not allowed now to spend more than 20%. If so, they have to reduce the premiums accordingly. Is that still true?
Dwight, thank you. 2 points there. And very quickly to you, Noam, his second point, the Affordable Care Act did say to insurers, you can only spend X amount on insurance. You have to spend the rest on, you know, coverage. That's correct, isn't it?
It is, yes.
Yeah. And his other point, though, about, well, not a public option. That was what was discussed when the Affordable Care Act was being debated. But the idea of single payer, we talked about that with Senator Bernie Sanders a couple weeks ago. That's what he's calling for. Noam, I wonder what you think. And then I have another question about a public option, which was also discussed earlier. But yeah, what do you think, Noam? Is anybody on the left saying, hey, this is too complicated? Hey, it's still too expensive administratively? Forget it.
Absolutely. Folks on the left are saying that. But, you know, one of the reasons why the Affordable Care Act passed was because folks on the left decided that they were willing to give up on that goal in exchange for another one, which was to guarantee coverage, which is something that this country never did before.
So they went with this more private sector alternative.
It was a private sector alternative that was heavily regulated by the government, which is sort of more in the American tradition in many ways than a single-payer system would be.
So that's why we went with this. And what do you think about Dwight's call for, you know, forget it, it's too expensive, let's go with a single-payer system. Any possibility of that in this country, Noam?
Oh, I mean, I don't think so. I mean, there wasn't the political will to do it when Democrats had historic majorities in Congress and control of the White House. I think there's no chance whatsoever in the current political environment that discussion will get looked at. But I will say this, that there's no question that the administrative cost in this country is enormous, and the headaches that doctors and hospitals deal with because they have to deal with a huge number of different kinds of plans make the system even more unpleasant than it already is. And I think there is a chance that if we can get to a point in Washington and this country where we can have a more rational discussion about health policy, that figuring out ways to simplify the system by, for example, trying to standardize the kind of medical plans that folks have to shop amongst is something that may get some attention. People are bewildered as consumers by the choices that they have, and providers are just driven nuts by it.
Well, Marianne, that's where you come in. You know, the exchanges were supposed to be, I hate to use this because it's so worn out, but the Travelocity of healthcare. You mm-hmm. go on, you put in a couple numbers, you say, okay, and you hit enter, and voila, you have all the information in front of you. So it was supposed to be like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I mean, there are, you know, a lot of great educational you know, places out there you can go to try to get, you know, down the weeds about certain health plans. And as, you know, I discussed earlier, you know, we went from open enrollment 1 with, you know, 12 options to open enrollment 3, where we now have over 40 options. And really, how can consumers go through and pick out the best plan for them? And, you know, it's going to take time, and it's going to take, you know, more on the ground people to try to help navigate the different plans and help direct people in the best way.
And I have read nationally, and I wonder if you see this in New Hampshire, Marianne, I have read that given the complexity and given the rising, you know, costs that we've been talking about, deductibles and so forth, that some people, especially the young invincibles that Ray talked about, are just saying, forget it. And even though the hope was eventually this population would sign up, they're just not doing it. They'd rather pay the fine.
Yeah, I mean, I haven't actually entirely seen that. On the ground, we have seen a lot of young invincibles coming in and you know, setting up meetings with navigators and application counselors, because they, you know, do understand this is a complete healthcare paradigm shift. And, you know, moving forward, you will need to have that coverage. And I think a lot of young invincibles do necessarily understand the importance of it. And it's just getting to that step to actually signing up.
Well, and here's an email that came in from Terrell, who says, for healthy families, he says, I'm a huge supporter of the Affordable Care Act, but for healthy families like mine, the exchange programs are basically extremely expensive major medical plans. We typically do not go to the doctor at all during the year, except for my daughter's annual pediatric visit. With our $6,000 deductible on top of the $8,000 to $10,000 we pay in premiums, wow, Terrell, we end up paying for any care we actually use. I would much rather have the cheaper major medical plans of old, same benefits I'm getting now, but much lower premiums. Thank you very much, Terrell, for that email. What do you think, Noam? This is what we started talking about, right? I mean, the hope that this would help lower costs is not always playing out for folks.
Well, there are a lot of issues there, but I want to make one point, which I think is important for folks to realize about sort of one of the reasons why we have this situation and why folks, particularly in this situation, who were able to get insurance before the Affordable Care Act passed, may be sort of the most down on what the law does. People who were able to get insurance before coverage was guaranteed essentially benefited from a market that was distorted by the fact that sick people couldn't get coverage. And to Ray's point earlier about how insurance works and how it is basically transferring risk from one population to another and how sick people are going to take out more than they actually pay, if you were able to buy insurance before 2010, you were probably pretty healthy. And as a result, you probably could get something that was pretty inexpensive because there was a much lower chance that health plan that you bought would ever have to pay a really big medical bill. And one of the trade-offs that the Affordable Care Act presented to the country was sick people would be able to get coverage. And that meant that more sick people would get coverage and more sick people would get their bills paid by insurance plans that all of us are subsidizing.
So as you bring in more of those folks, costs go up.
Exactly.
Wow.
And that's a trade-off that the law made, and it's difficult to get away from that unless we're prepared as a country to say we actually don't think that we should cover everybody who's sick.
Well, Terrell, thank you for the email. And all of you, we have to close out. There's so much more that we could have talked about, but I really appreciate all of you coming in today. Noam Levy, thank you so much for being here.
My pleasure.
Noam Levy with the LA Times, Marianne White and Ray White, thank you also for giving us your time. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
This is The Exchange on NHPR.